गौर प्रेमानंदी हरि हरि ओ So our journey or our story, our experience today is the first of three sections of the sixth canto that we're going to share together. So as I said last night, the sixth canto is particularly significant because it describes the Lord's poshana, or how he nourishes his devotees. And it describes that the Lord showers his mercy even upon those who are misbehaved. So we were reflecting on this, how this is quite valuable for us, because we may find ourselves to be imperfect in our devotional qualifications and our devotional endeavors even, or even in our interest in devotional service. And yet, the Lord is very merciful even to somebody who has such disqualification. So in this particular section of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it describes the nature of bhakti. And it describes that if the Lord's devotee commits a crime, they do not fall down from the path of bhakti, but they are elevated. That's very extraordinary. You mean to say I can commit crimes? I can make advancement by making myself into a criminal? Well, that's not exactly what is meant by this. But this is a glorification of the power and the potency of the bhakti process, that even if one makes a mistake or does something wrong, by the power of bhakti, one will still become gradually elevated. So please hear now about King Indra, because he's going to give us help in understanding this principle. The first chapters of the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam describe the life and the example of Ajamila. Can everyone please turn off their mobile phone? And in the life of Ajamila, we see that he had some devotion, some piety early in his life, and he fell from that practice, and later on, by the power of the Lord's holy name, he was saved. So Maharaj Parikit continues to listen as Sukadeva Goswami continues to narrate the Bhagavatam to him. And Sukadeva, as is necessary and required in any Puranic writing, he gives here and there in the Bhagavatam the genealogy of many kings. This king, this king, this king, this king. And in this list of names, you see that time just keeps moving and moving and moving and moving, and how inconsequential is our tiny lifespan in the whole course of eternity. And so he begins in the fourth chapter, to explain to the king the lifespan and the dynasty coming from beginning with up to Prajapati Daksha. He's speaking there about all the different... just a second. Okay. He's speaking about the dynasties that came from Daksha, And Daksha, he took birth as the son, the only son of the sons of Prachinabahisat, who was the son of Swayambhuvamanu, who was the son of Lord Brahma. So Lord Brahma is the son of Lord Narayan, you can say, the progeny of Lord Narayan. And so this is only some generations into the secondary creation of the material universe. Now, I might ask you a question, or I may confess something. That as I was reading this about Prajapati Daksha, and he had 60 daughters, first he had 10,000 sons, but Narada came, and he preached to them, and they became revolutionarily devotional, and they decided to disobey the order of their father, who had sent them to practice purification for the purpose of propagation. And they decided against this, and they left and they took up a life of renunciation. And Daksha was very upset. Then he had 5,000 sons, and he sent them to the same place to perform the same kind of austerities so that they could take up the propagation of the population, populating the universes. And Narada came again and he spoke with them. And he convinced them that actually this was not really in their best interest to do this. And he gave them a mantra. He spoke something very cryptic to them, pointing out something to do with, shouldn't the younger brothers follow the older brothers? And then he told them an analogy, and they were so intelligent they understood exactly what he meant, and they also left. And when Daksha noted that all of his sons had all been turned away from the order that he had given them by Narada, he became so angry, and he decided to have daughters instead. So he had 60 daughters. And Narada didn't do anything to turn his daughters in the direction of renunciation. And so Daksha, he raised his daughters, and then he gave them to different sages. He gave, I think, 30 of them to Kasyapa Muni. He gave some to Angira. He gave some to different of the great sages in the universe. And then Maharaj Sukadeva Goswami is explaining to Maharaj Parikit about the dynasty that came from Daksha through his 60 daughters, specifically the different sages, and finally he comes to the final one or the main one, Kasyapa, because Kasyapa had so many of the daughters of Daksha. And can you think who is the most primary daughter of Daksha that Kasyapa was married to? Who is that at the back? Aditi and Diti are the two most primary ones, because Aditi gives birth to all of the demigods. That dynasty comes from her. And Diti gives birth to all the daityas or the danavas or those who are materialistic. So the difference between a demigod and a materialistic person, Srila Prabhupada explains, is that the demigods in difficulty will turn to Lord Vishnu. And the materialist or the asura or the non-devotee, or Prabhupada used the term demon, they will turn instead, if they turn to anyone, they will turn to Lord Shiva or to Durga, or they will turn to one of the demigods and they will pray to them. And the demigods will always have the blessings of Lord Vishnu. So basically the demigods turn out successful, more successful in this way, in terms of that the demigods tend to be able to defeat their enemies, the demons. So, we come, by hearing this this genealogical list of all the different family members coming from Daksha, we come to hear of Tvasta. He was one of the 12 sons of Aditi. And there is no genealogical furtherance of him. Srila Sukadeva Goswami explains that he had 12 sons. One of them was Kosta, and he had two sons, and one of them was Vishvarupa, and Vishvarupa stops. So Maharaj Parikshit asks, so what happened with Vishvarupa? And this begins the story of Indra. So then, after asking this question about Vishvarupa, just a second, I'll get myself up to my place. He says, although Vishvarupa was the son of the daughter of their eternal enemies, the demons, the demigods accepted him as their priest in accordance with the order of Lord Brahma when they were abandoned by their spiritual master, Brihaspati, whom they had disrespected. Now this was enough to make Maharaj Parikshit curious. You see, a good listener is listening to a subject, and while they're listening to it, they're thinking, I wonder why that happened, and that must have been very interesting. I'd like to hear more about that. And how can I apply this to myself? Does it apply to me? And this is an active listener. And a passive listener means that after they have heard something, and perhaps most of us admit ourselves as passive listeners, someone says, you say, that was a very good class, and they say, what was it about? And you say, I can't remember. But Maharaj Parikshit was on the doorstep of death. So he was the most serious active listener, because he was preparing himself, for just around the corner was his final examination of his whole life. And so therefore he was listening very carefully. And so he became curious about this. And he asked his guru, Sukadeva Goswami, why did this spiritual master of the demigods, Brihaspati, reject them? Because they were his disciples. And what offense did they do against their spiritual master? Please describe this incident. And so this begins, this particular section of the sixth canto, describing the story of Vritrasura. So please hear what it's like to be King Indra, because it might attract you. You might be interested in it. It's quite nice. Sukadeva says, once upon a time, the king of heaven Indra, being extremely proud because of his great opulence of the three worlds, transgressed the law of Vedic etiquette. Well, that's not so nice, but here is his situation. He was seated upon his throne, surrounded by the Maruts, the Vasus, the Rudras, the Adityas, the Rishabhas, the Vishvadevas, the Sadyas, the Ashvini Kumars, the Siddhas, the Charanas, and the Gandharvas. Now these are all great, very exalted, very highly qualified personalities from different higher planetary systems, as well as by many great saintly persons. In front of him, as he's seated on his beautiful golden throne, he is very handsome, Indra. You should understand, Indra means he's the best. Mahendra means he's the very, very best. And what is he very good at? He's very good at, well, if we put it very simply, he's very good at seducing women. In fact, in the Bhagavatam, in the second canto, you can see in chapter 3, it explains that if you are interested in certain things, you should worship certain demigods. If you want progeny, worship the Prajapatis. If you want to be very sensually strong, worship Indra. So this is what Indra is good at. So you can imagine Indra is so strong, handsome, like no movie star you've ever seen. So wonderful. And there he is, so potent and so, like, attractive. And everyone is around him, surrounding him, magnetized by his aura and his strength. And they're all there. And the apsaras, the dancing girls, are dancing incredibly beautiful dances in front of him. And they don't make one wrong move. Everything is perfect in their beauty and in their excellence. And there they are dancing. The Vidyadharas are singing. The Apsaras are dancing. And all of them are offering Indra their respects and services. The Apsaras and Gandharvas are dancing and singing with very sweet musical instruments. And over Indra's head is a white umbrella, as effulgent as the full moon. So beautiful. It must be so incredible. Imagine going there. Look, I mean, you live in Melbourne, Australia, and maybe it's a little bit more exciting than Perth, Australia, Western Australia, but still, it's so ugra. It's so much cement and steel and all your technology, even no matter how subtle we think the computer is, it's so gross compared to the pleasures that are available to Indra. He has such an amazingly wonderful life. He's fanned by yak-tail whisks and served with all the paraphernalia of a great king. And he's sitting with his wife Sachi Devi, who occupies half the throne. When suddenly Brihaspati, who is his guru, this sage amongst the demigods, appeared in that assembly. Brihaspati, the best of sages, was the spiritual master of Indra and the demigods, and was respected by the demigods and the demons alike. Nevertheless, although Indra saw his spiritual master before him, he did not stand up from his seat, and he did not offer a seat to his spiritual master. Nor did Indra do anything to show respect. Now, this was the first thing when I started reading this that really struck me. I started trying to imagine myself, have the experience of being in Indra's position with all of this magnetic power coming towards you, and you're so attractive and you're so strong, something that everyone secretly, quietly, somewhere in their heart or mind would love to be, as much as they could. And then in comes their guru. And you see him, he's there, you know, he's important, but right now you're quite indisposed towards him. You're not inclined towards taking his association, you're instead enjoying life. And Indra could see, as we read in the purport, he could see Brihaspati every day. He came every day to see him. It wasn't a special event. So we, likewise, we do Guru Puja every day, we do our sadhana, we try to do our sadhana every day, and it doesn't seem like a special event to us. So when I started to think about this, I could feel myself being drawn into the Indra category very quickly, and it was quite scary, because I could see that from the position of Indra, as I looked out at everything, I saw the world in the sense that it was like, what's here for me? And now I have all of this opulence that Indra has. So what do I need? So Guru, he comes in, you will offer some like this, but not from the heart. Not from any deep kind of a place do we offer respects when we're very, very much absorbed in the pleasures and the opulences of this world. Anyway, it's interesting that in the verse come further up, when Indra sees, when Brihaspati sees the condition of Indra, he turns around and he leaves. And not only does he leave, but he makes himself invisible. And in the verse explains that the reason he did this is because he has greater power than Indra. So he made himself invisible. And Indra immediately realized what he had done wrong, how he had been disrespectful. And he said to all of those who are present, I have made a terrible offense at the feet of my spiritual master. I should go immediately and seek his forgiveness. And I will bow my head and I will tell him I'm very, very sorry. And he should please, please accept my forgiveness and so on and so forth. But even when you're reading the verses in the Bhagavatam, you can feel, and also if you've allowed yourself to feel what it's like to be in the position of Indra, you can feel how there's not full sincerity in the heart when you do that. You just feel like, oh, I've made a mistake. How can I fix it? I'll fix that up, and everything will be all right, and we'll go on as everything's fine. So Indra was thinking like that. I have failed to show respect. I will go down. I condemn my wealth and everything else. Oh me, oh my, I have made a terrible mistake. Let me fix it. But Brihaspati did not allow him to find him. And he looked everywhere for Brihaspati. And as soon as he couldn't find him, he could no longer perform the rituals, the practices that were keeping his power intact. And so the demons heard about this, that he had offended his guru, and immediately they attacked. Just like you can say, the bad qualities in our heart, as soon as we make some offense, they know, aha, this is the chance. And immediately they rise up in strength, and all of a sudden we feel indifference to spiritual values, because now we feel like, let me just go with, and we go with these material desires and so forth that are always there as eternally in a balance, but the power of respect of Guru keeps them down, and the disrespect allows them to come up. So the Asuras came up and they attacked Indra and they harmed him greatly and his prestige, and he was in great distress. So what would he do? He decided he would go to Lord Brahma, because Lord Brahma would advise him what to do under difficulty. So he did. He went to Lord Brahma, and Lord Brahma first of all said, it's hard to imagine that anyone would be so foolish as to disrespect a person of the caliber of Brihaspati, who is honored by everyone. So he made his point. And then he told Indra that if you want good fortune and you want everything to go on well, you should approach the son of Tvastha. Now Tvastha is one of the sons of Aditi, and also Indra is one. So you could say they were brothers. So he said, approach the son of Tvastha, Vishvarup, and ask him to become your Purohit, or your priest, for performing the rituals to benefit the family. You can approach him, beg his assistance, provided that you are prepared to tolerate the fact that he has he's favorable towards the Asuras. Now, why is he favorable towards the Asuras, the demons, and the demigods? That is because his mother, Rachana, is coming from the Daitya side. He's coming from this side, and his father's coming from this side. So Vishwarup has a partiality to both sides. So King Indra comes, and he speaks such wonderful prayers to Vishwarup. He's so diplomatic, and he prays to him that, please, it is the duty of a son, even if he has his own sons, to take care of the needs of the father. And we are just like your fathers. So please, we pray to you that you will come and act as our guru, as a guru for our well-being, and that you will allow us to defeat our enemies and have all prosperity. So here is a point. This is what Indra's interested in. So we have to very carefully, if we want to make spiritual advancement, we have to examine our own hearts and see, is that all I'm interested in too? Destroying my enemies and having prosperity. Because if that's all we're interested in, then we should put our names on the list of Indra's camp. Because that was what he was interested in. So they prayed to Vishwarup very, very fine prayers, and they asked him to please come and protect their well-being by accepting this role as a priest. And they said, it doesn't matter that you're younger, because you have so much spiritual knowledge, so there is no shame in being our priest. Please. Vishwarupa offered some words, wise words, expressing that one should not become a professional priest or become a priest just to make money and to take care of material things. That was condemnable. But he said, because you are my uncles, my father, just like my father, I cannot but accept your offer and I will become your priest. So now the demigods are again on the up. They were on the down and now they're on the up. And so Vishvarupa begins to make so many sacrifices and homas and rituals and so forth, and he's making oblations to the fire and he's praying and offering different articles for the well-being of the demigods. And along with that, he has one special mantra that he knows. It's called the Narayan Kavacha. Now this Narayan Kavacha is like an armor, made a subtle armor made of mantras. So we have no real experience of this, I don't think, in any way. People think of mantras made of, armor made of, protection made of electricity, or they can have different kind of subtle, invisible protective fields. But to be protected by the sound of a mantra is beyond most persons' understanding. But Vishwarupa had learnt this from his father Tvastra, how to chant mantras, and you touch different parts of the body, and you chant these mantras to various incarnations of Lord Vishnu, and this will protect you from all kinds of danger, from enemies, from political powers who are trying to give you difficulty, from diseases. It will protect you. It will protect you from all sorts of things. So Indra, he accepts this from Vishvarup, and he starts to chant this Narayan Kavacha, Narayan Kavacha. And by chanting the Narayan Kavacha, he becomes very powerful. And what Vishvarup does, in effect, is he takes the power from the demon and provides it for the power of the demigod. They get they're less powerful and they're more powerful. This is the power of this mantra to Lord Narayan. So now everything becomes good again. The demigods are peaceful and happy and everything's going well and everybody is pleased. However, as we received warning earlier, Vishvarupa has a partiality towards both sides. So some time goes by, and Lord King Indra discovers that Vishvarupa is secretly cheating the demigods by offering half the oblations to the demigods and half the oblations to the asuras, because his mother instructed him like that. He doesn't want either side to be in any difficulty, so he offers something for the demigods, something for the demons. And when Indra finds out this, he becomes so angry. So angry. He feels so cheated that his priest is doing this. And he becomes so afraid of again being attacked and defeated by the demons. And in great anger at Vishvarupa, he cuts off Vishvarupa's three heads. Now, when I was reading this, I'm going to make a confession here. As I was reading this, I was thinking, do I believe this? Do I believe that? And then it explains that these three heads turned into three little birds. Do I believe this? Because you see, we have to sometimes confront our doubts. It's very strengthening. For us as Westerners coming towards the Vedic culture, we have a particular mindset. We want things to be clear-cut and decisive and analyzable, and if possible, we should be able to see it. And then we'll accept it. And for Indians who have a different kind of a psychology, they can manage to have this thing here. It's a little hard to understand, but culturally my auntie or grandmother told me, so it can be there and that can be here. But what they fall guilty of is they deeply, deeply believe, consciously or unconsciously, that this is mythology. And so we should take our fault and examine it, whether it be that we want it to be analytically correct, provable, or whether we think that, yes, this is our culture, we have heard these stories, this is the Bhagavad, but it is stories. Because if we stay in a doubtful state of mind when we come in touch with the Bhagavatam, how will we make any advancement? So if we don't know we have doubts, how will we clear our doubts? So for me, when I started to read this, first time I started reading the Bhagavatam in this section to prepare this class, my mind at a certain point said, I don't think I believe this. And I was a little shocked because here I am, I'm going to give the class, and I became quite perturbed that you're going to give a class and you don't believe this. So then I thought, oh, this is Krishna's mercy, because he's asking me to go a little deeper into the subject of my disbelief and the subject of the Bhagavatam. So I started to think about this. And just that very same day, a friend came to visit me, and we were sitting in our temple room where we stay at Gopinath Dham. And we were talking about some topic, and I was telling her what I'd read and how I had difficulty really believing this. And then she looked at me in a very simple way, and she said, just imagine if there was an ant and it was crawling across the floor. Yes? And she said, just imagine if that ant was informed about us being here. What would the ant think? There's two gigantic women in this room. They're like huge, you know, proportionate to the size of an ant. How big are we? And they can just go like that and destroy, or they can pour water down our ant house, our ant hill, and just destroy it in a moment according to their whim. Just imagine if somebody told them that. Maybe they would say, I don't believe that. How can I believe that? How can there be anyone so big in all of existence? And when she said this to me, I started to think, am I just like an ant? Am I also like that? Saying, I don't believe it. I can't see it. So why are you going to ask me to believe it? And then later I found a nice quote from Srila Prabhupada, which we will read later, where he said that actually he described different people see the Bhagavatam this way, that way, they doubt it in this way or that way. And only an acharya has full realization of the Bhagavatam. So only hearing from an acharya can you ever get the strength of faith and clear that doubtful mentality. Because in his association, he believes it. He believes it. He doesn't have this ant-like mentality. I can't see it. Maybe it's not true. Because he has full realization of Krishna. So only when we have advanced to the stage of full realization of Krishna can we say also, well, I have no doubt about this. And how are we going to get there? We have to deal with the doubts as they arise in a positive way by taking shelter as much as we can of Srila Prabhupada, his purports, his lectures, hearing him, and associating with other devotees who are doing the same thing, and also speaking, because when you speak, you realize your own defects. Anyway, back to our story. So Indra, he nullified for himself the reactions of killing Vishvarupa. He's very powerful, he's an Ishwar. But Tvastra was very, very upset. And so he performed a yajna. And from that yajna, he chanted mantras into the fire. He had so many qualified Brahmins there, and you can see the picture in the Bhagavatam. And he chanted the mantras to produce from the fire somebody who had the power to kill Indra. But unfortunately, as fate would have it, he chanted one of the mantras. It had a short ah, and he chanted a long ah, and he changed the meaning of the mantra from one who could kill Indra, to one to whom Indra would become an enemy. Interestingly enough, from the fire, a huge personality came, huge, massive, right up into the cloud, with flaming hair and dark skin, and full of anger, because Srila Prabhupada says, this person that was formed from this chanting was the personification of Tvastha's anger. And he was so powerful. He was full of anger, this person that was created. He was so vast, and he was called Vritra, because Vritra means one who covers everything. And when Indra saw this, he became terrified, because this personality was massive, way, way, way above Indra's power, way above Indra's size or stature or anything. It's like the ant, right? If all of a sudden the ant could open his eyes and see we were standing there like this, we're going to take you out of this room, he would be so horrified. Look at this. So Indra was like that. Indra immediately decided to attack, and he went forth with his attack, and Vritrasura just swept them away. So all the demigods now became very frightened. Now remember, he had just received a Narayan Kavacha, an armor from Lord Narayan, but he forgot all about that. Now he was just full of anxiety again. And this time, what did he do? He went and prayed to Lord Narayan himself. So the demigods came together, all of them were afraid, and they offered prayers to Lord Narayan, and their prayers are very nice, and their prayers have many good points in them. But we won't go into them in detail right now. There was one point that struck me when I read it. They said, the Supreme Lord who creates us by his external potency, and by whose mercy we expand the creation of the universe, is always situated within us as the Supersoul. He's with us. But we cannot see him. We cannot see him because all of us think that we are separate and independent gods. So these points, we should take them for ourselves as well. We may think, I don't think I'm a separate, independent God, but at least we would like to feel that I'm a separate, independent controller, at least of my life. And if I'm not a separate, independent controller of my life, I'm going to be miserable, because things are going to happen to me that I don't want, and then I'm going to have to counteract them. And I'm going to have to work very hard to try and make my life the way I want my life to be. And in this battle to make things in this way, we actually find ourselves thinking of ourselves as a very small, separate, and independent God. So they offered very wonderful, profound prayers to the Lord. But they also admitted that, of course, you know everything. So you know why we have come. We don't need to actually ask you this. But please, please do something to get rid of this monster. Please destroy Vritrasura immediately. So after they had prayed, they listened, and the Lord's voice they heard. And what did he say? When the demigods offered the Lord their sincere prayers in this way, the Lord listened by his causeless mercy. Just think, when we offer prayers, he listens. He listens. It's not just a mental something we do in our head. He listens to us. And he became pleased with them, even though their prayers were materialistic, and their prayers were for help to get rid of some problem that they were facing in their lives. Their prayers weren't for more than that. Still, he listened to them, and he replied to them. He said, you have offered your prayers to me with great knowledge, and I am certainly most pleased with you. A person is liberated by such knowledge, and thus he remembers my exalted position, which is above the conditions of material life. Such a devotee is fully purified by offering prayers in full knowledge. Now actually they offered prayers, yes, there was knowledge, but still there was not full knowledge, right? Because their prayer was, please destroy this obstacle in our lives. So then the Lord says to them, O best of intelligent demigods, although it is true that nothing is difficult for one to obtain when I am pleased with him, a pure devotee whose mind is exclusively fixed in me does not ask me for anything except the opportunity to engage in my service. So here is something that now he is explaining to them. And Srila Prabhupada, in his purport, he says that when the demigods finished their prayers and they were eagerly awaiting some results that the Lord should incarnate and destroy their misery, Prabhupada says, although he could do that, and he will do that, he wanted the demigods to actually be praying for pure devotional service. Instead, they prayed for an opportunity to kill their enemy. This is the difference between a pure devotee and a devotee on the material platform. And indirectly, the Lord regretted that the demigods did not come to ask for pure devotional service. So please note, the demigods are devotees. They take shelter of Lord Vishnu. But they're considered material devotees because, especially Indra, he's an administrator of the material universe. Practically speaking, Indra is a title, it's a post. Different personalities take the role of Indra. He's in charge of the rain. Without rain, and no one can have any food. We cannot live without water. So he has a very responsible position. But his interest, his real interest, is in prolonging his enjoyment here. This is the point. This is what is in the foreground of his consciousness. How can I enjoy life here? So this is called a mixed devotee. And I'd have to say for myself, I'm embarrassed to admit, and perhaps many of us would have to say, that sounds a bit like me. But we will hear more so that we can, by hearing of a higher level of devotee, we can get the feeling that it would be actually very nice to rise above this level, this materialistic devotional level, and come to this platform of pure devotional service. It would actually be very, very nice. But now we're hearing about Indra. So the Lord said to him, O Mahamagavan Indra, all good fortune to you. I advise you to approach the exalted Saint Dadichi. He has become very accomplished in knowledge and vows and austerities. And his body is very strong. Go and ask him for his body. Now think about that. If somebody's coming to you to ask you for a favor, and their favor is, I'm in trouble, could you give me your body? So this Dadichi is a muni, he's a sage. He's on a different level than we are. But Dadichi's protective covering, invincible protective covering, known as the Narayan Kavacha. The Dadichi was the one who gave the Narayan Kavacha to Twasta. And Twasta gave it to his son Vishwarup, from whom you have received it. Because of this Narayan Kavacha, the Dadichi's body is now very strong. Go, therefore, and beg him for his body. What an embarrassing position to be put in. Indra had killed Vishwaroop. He had killed the son of Tvasta. He'd already been given the Narayan Kavacha by him. And he killed him. And now he's going to ask the person who taught this mantra to sacrifice his life to satisfy Indra from the reaction of killing the person who was his guru who gave it to him. Just see, in the Bhagavatam, Indra is made to appear a little bit embarrassed in many, many cases. We will hear about some of them this afternoon. In the Rig Veda, if you're interested in doing any research on the internet, you'll find that in the Rig Veda, Indra is considered to be the greatest hero. And those who have a very faulty understanding of Indology or Hinduism, or what to speak of Vedic culture, they, as false scholars, they claim that in the Rig Veda, Indra was the hero. Indra was so wonderful. He's Mahadev, the lord of all the devas. And later on, within the last 2,000 years, this idea of Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva, the trilogy that was introduced. Now people also, they worship this, and somehow or other, Indra went out of fashion. Because they have no pure knowledge. And so they're like blind men trying to work out what an elephant is. An elephant is a long tail. An elephant is a leathery feeling. An elephant is a big flap. They can't actually understand properly anything. But the Bhagavatam, when illuminated by a transcendentally pure person, a person on the platform of pure devotional service, only then it offers a vision of what is pure devotional service. Otherwise, not. So here, Indra goes, and he goes and prays to the Dadichi Muni and asks him, please, if you could give us your bones, because I have to make a thunderbolt. Because you see, Indra, he always has a thunderbolt. I need my vajra, my thunderbolt. So please, my dear sir. So Dadichi, he offers a few words to point out that it is not wise sometimes to ask somebody for charity that's greater than what they can give. A person who is asking for charity should only ask what a person's capable of giving. So he makes a little point at Indra's expense. But then he agrees, because he's transcendental to his body. So he sits down in a yogic trance, and he mentally takes his life airs up. He releases himself from his body. His body is there. Indra takes his body, gives the bones to Vishvakarma. And sometimes it is said that Vishvakarma and Tvasta are the same personality. So then a thunderbolt is made. But the last thing that the Lord said to Indra before he took off to get the bones of Dadichi, he said to him, when he was speaking, he said, when Vritrasura is killed because of my spiritual strength, you will regain your strength, your weapons, and your wealth. This is very interesting. When Vritrasura is killed, which implies that Vritrasura will be killed because Indra has gone and prayed, when he's killed by my strength, not by your strength, you will get back your strength, your weapons, and your wealth. So Indra, in this fight, you will get your wealth, your weapons, and your strength. And thus there will be good fortune for all of you, both sides. Although Vritrasura can destroy all the three worlds, he's so powerful, do not fear that he will harm you. He's so terrifying. Don't be afraid of him. He is also a devotee, and he will never be envious of you. Now, we have a fight about to take place. There's the good and the bad in a fight. And the bad one, we're hearing, don't be afraid of him. He won't be envious of you. But Indra, is he envious? He has the envy. He's the deva. And this one, is not envious. So this is a very, very, I would say, mysterious pastime, because a fight is about to take place. But the way the fight takes place and the relationship between the two persons is most extraordinary. If you go outside here and two people are fighting, some bad man comes onto the property and one devotee is trying to get him to leave, and they're fighting, that man will be so angry and he wants to do some harm and danger, and the devotee will have to become also angry to fight with him and protect. And it will be clear to understand, yes, this is good and this is bad. But in this fight, it is very, very difficult to understand clearly what is actually going on. Now, I'm going to stop here, and tomorrow we're going to hear more about what took place next. So today we only know that King Indra has got his Vajra, his thunderbolt, which is invincible because of the life that has been sacrificed by Dadichi. And he's all-powerful, he's ready to fight, and he's going to regain his wealth, strength, and weapons as a result of this battle. So let me stop here. And I would like to know, does anyone have any questions?
Krishna says that he takes away all the wealth of his devotees, but here it seems quite contradictory.
The question is, Krishna says that he takes away the wealth of all his devotees, but here he seems contradictory because he's going to give wealth to Indra. According to the context in which we are listening to someone when they're speaking to us, according to the context in which we're interested in what they're saying, we'll hear what they say differently. You might have one person speaking, giving a class, and 15 people are listening, and they all have their own state of mind, what they're musing on in their mind, what they're reflecting on, what's happening in their lives. And when that one person speaks, each one of them will come out of that class with a different understanding of the same subject. And if it's a child listening to the class, they'll have one particular way of understanding what's taking place. And a person who's got a very, very developed understanding of a subject will have a very penetrating understanding from the same subject matter being discussed. So similarly, when Krishna speaks in Bhagavad Gita, or when Krishna speaks in any place, according to what level we're on, we will understand it as such. So when Krishna says he takes away the wealth of his devotee, he's speaking on a level whereby he's speaking to somebody who's really his devotee. Who's really his devotee. And if we're not really his devotee, means we're partly his devotee, but not fully his devotee, then maybe he won't take away our wealth. But don't worry. But if somebody really, really is his devotee, he takes away their wealth. Why does he take away their wealth? Yes? So they remember him more, surrender him more, to him more, yes? They don't have to take time in managing wealth, yes? You could see by their difficulties and how they handle them, yes? Very nice, yes? He takes away the opulence if it's an obstacle to spiritual life. Yes. He takes away so they can get rid of sense gratification. So all these are all certainly points. Depending on the level, again, of the context in which we're listening or approaching Krishna, these things are all relevant. But on the highest level, the most total level, he takes away something so he can give something. Just like if you've got somebody and they come to take prasadam and you want to give them the plate and they're holding a box. You say, put that over there and take this. And the prasadam is so relishable and the box is just something they can put down. So similarly, what we now consider to be like so essential to us that we can't imagine how anyone would ever want to take it away from us, then we should think to ourselves, imagine what he wants to give if he wants to take that away. What we think is we couldn't live without, if he's wanting to take it away, what standard of giving is he going to give? But instead, because we're on a lower level, we think, my gosh, what could he give me that would replace the value of this? He can't take this away. I won't let him. I won't let you take this away. So then what happens? We come into conflict with him. We're in conflict with him. We're running from him. We're holding on to what we have. And we don't mind a few religious ritualistic ceremonies if they're going to increase what we have or protect it. But if there was any thought in the back of our mind that he was going to take it from us, then our devotional life would be very challenged. I think everyone can relate to that. And the irony of it is, the ironic part is that it's his. And we're his. It's his, we're his, he's there. We're nuts. It's his and we're his. It's like if your child took something from the house and wouldn't give it and you know, refused to, don't take this away from me, this is mine, you can't have this. And some insignificant thing in your house, and you think, what's wrong with them? They have like a light bulb. Don't take it. It's mine. You think, how can I reason with this child? And we think, of course, that's a child. And we'll maybe laugh a little bit because it's a child. So Krishna similarly, with his mixed devotees, those who are in this state where they're thinking, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine, he treats them in that way, like children. He doesn't threaten them and pull the rug out from underneath them. He doesn't do that. And when we have difficulty, we should note this. When we have difficulty, and sometimes people say in a wrong way, oh, this is Krishna's mercy, he's taking everything away. We should understand in a more deeper way, because the deeper we are, the greater our knowledge, the more peaceful our lives will be. And the shallower we are and the less knowledge we have, the more turbulent our life will be. So we should understand and discern there's karma here. Krishna is minimizing the karma. He's not making it worse. He's trying to reduce it. He says this. Prabhupada says this. Do I believe it? Or do I believe my mind? Or do I believe something that I've concocted or thought through myself in a shallow, superficial way? So the reality is that the difficulties that are coming because of what we have done. He's not trying to calculate how to give us the next difficult moment. This is not his mercy. This is not his business. He doesn't do this. He has agents do that. If you want to come into this material world, you come under the control of agents. If you want to turn to him, you deal directly with him. Otherwise, you deal with the agencies of the material nature. And the material nature, according to our activities, Krishna is all merciful. But the material nature is meticulous. Every single activity is monitored by the material energy. And you'll get a corresponding result from it. So rather than being afraid of Krishna because he's chasing me to take away my sin, we should learn to become afraid of the material world. It's a dangerous place. And we should learn how to transfer our attachment and the attachment of those who we're fond of to the best of our ability to taking shelter of Him by the right understanding. At least we should have the right understanding. How can you help another person if you don't have the right understanding? On the aeroplane, when the oxygen mask falls, you put your own mask on first, and then you put the mask on those who are with you. This is so important. So many times we're thinking in our minds, and when I say we, I have to say I'm saying me, but it's, you know, the royal we, like the Queen says we. That's called the royal we. You include everybody, but she's speaking of herself. So I'm not, obviously not speaking like the Queen, but so many times when I say we, I mean me. I'm thinking, I wish that person heard this. It would really help them a lot. They could get their Krishna consciousness together. And I wish that my son was here. He could hear it too, and that would help him. And I don't think, what about me? And that tendency to think about others is a very clever plot of the mind to deflect it from actually going into our lives. It looks like it's altruistic, but it isn't at all. It should be going into our heart. We should be thinking, what about me? How am I going to make spiritual advancement? What if Krishna took all my wealth away? What would I do? What would you do? I would lament. Yes, I'd be thinking, oh no, what has happened? Oh, how can I get it back? I would be thinking like Indra. So this is very interesting to see. So then Krishna, he doesn't take it away. It may go because of your previous sinful activities. It may leave your hands and disappear, but Krishna doesn't take it away. No reason to, because it's not going to be of any value, because he can't give you the thing that he wants to give you if you don't want it. So everything then gets carried out by nature. The modes of nature, karma, all these things. Nobody is free of this. We will hear this afternoon, Indra, to the top person, Indra, highest administrating demigod, down to the Indra Gopa, which is a macrobiotic, tiny, tiny bug, and everyone in between. Everyone is under the law of karma. The actions for their actions must come. You have to face it. If you don't want to face it, no problem. The reaction for that will also come. See? So if you gain knowledge, and if you gain devotion, and if you gain the kind of a vision of what's above all of this, and look around and realize that that's much better, then you're so fortunate. So fortunate. So this is why we hear the Bhagavatam, and this is what we need to learn from the Bhagavatam. Yes, ma'am. More materialistic than he's devotional. Yes. The good quality is that whenever he's in difficulty, he takes shelter of the Lord. So it's just like, say, you have a son. Whenever he's having a problem, he comes home and says, I'm having a difficulty. Can you help me? Of course you'll help him. So this is the good quality of the demigods. They take shelter of the Lord. And because they have that good quality, they're exalted. And because if a devotee has that tendency to take shelter of the Lord in difficulty, he's also exalted. But he's not as exalted as somebody who takes shelter of the Lord, not in difficulty, but in everything. Right? If you have an obedient son who does everything that you want all the time, continuously, only wants to serve you, has no other interest but seeing your pleasure, That's one son. And you have another son. He does whatever he wants. But when he's in difficulty, he comes home and asks you for help. You'll help them both. But one will give you more pleasure than the other. So therefore, we're hearing about two levels. And we may find ourselves as the second level. But we're invited to come towards, move towards the other level. Any more? Yes. Yes. What was the difference between the two? One could only say the quality of the person was different. But one of them, when he saw the Lord, he actually saw the Lord. Demigods, they prayed like this, but they only heard him. They see him. He appears sometimes to help them. But they're performing certain duties, and within those duties, they have certain desires. That's why they're placed in that position. Dhruv Maharaj, one thing that was different was that Dhruva Maharaj received the blessings and mercy of Narada. Because Dhruva Maharaj was in this family line, same family line, the Daksha came through. He was the nephew of Prachinabahi. So you could say, in a sense, just a few generations before was Dhruva Maharaj. Dhruva Maharaj also had this desire for power and kingdom and fame and everything else. And then he went and he prayed for it. He was incited to greater intensity because of the insult he received. But then when he saw the Lord, because of his sincere practice, that desire changed in his heart. So later on in this series of classes, we'll hear about somebody else who was like that, who had desires. And then when they saw the Lord, their desires changed. They still had some residue material desires of some sort, but most everything was gone. So Dhruva Maharaj, most everything was gone. Indra, he plays the role of giving us the example that he wants to stay in the material world. He's fond of his position and his opulence. And we heard just a little tiny description of what standard of living he maintains. He's fond of that. No. You have to have the desire to become purified. There's two sides to bhakti. There's the mercy side, seeing of the Lord, and then there's the quality of the heart of the aspirant. If the aspirant doesn't want to become purified, even when they see the Lord, they appreciate and they receive the benediction, but they don't necessarily become fully purified by that. There are examples in the Bhagavatam. You can see them. Something has to come from us. We're wanting it all to come from him. He should do the work. But something has to come from us. Otherwise, there's no relationship. Relationship means something has to come from me, something comes there. I do something, something comes back. I do more, something comes back. That's a strengthening of a relationship. Generally, materialistic devotees are thinking God should do it. He should fix it up. I have a problem in my life. This is wrong and that's wrong and this is like this. He should fix that. Thank you. I know. So, no. we have to have the right quality of heart also. Yes. Vritra. Well, that's it. You're stepping a little ahead. But yes, that's the big question. You got it. Congratulations. That's what happened to me. I was like, how come? Hang on here. How come he has envy and he doesn't have envy, and it's supposed to be the other way around, right? It's supposed to be the other way around. He's big, he's fearful, he's angry, he has envy. And Indra is, he's a demigod, he shouldn't have envy. How come? So these questions is very nice, thank you for bringing that up. Because this afternoon we'll hear some more things about Indra, some different points that Srila Prabhupada makes to help us to understand these things. Do you mean to say that we can think that, well, Indra's not so great because he does something wrong? Is that what you're referring to? Yes, yes. And then we can feel that, well, Indra's not so great, so I he goes down and automatically I go up. Well, it doesn't work like that. Up's up and down's down. They remain permanently like that. But in our mind they can go like that, right? But actually in reality they remain like that. So there's something interesting here. That we can do so many things in our mind. We can think this way, that way, use our mind to justify something, validate something, make ourselves seem more important, less important. We can do so much. It's all going on up here. Ding, 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 up here, right? It's all going on up here. It's not going on out there. Nobody else is aware of it. Nobody else is thinking, oh yes, you have just suddenly become greater because Indra did this. No one else is thinking that. Only we're thinking like this. So this is the nature of the mind. And this is very important to understand how the mind works, because when you understand it, you can recognize it when it starts to play up. So here's a good one. Oh, so-and-so did that? I haven't done that. I've done lots of bad things, but I didn't do that, so I must be just a bit better than them. But you'd have to put on the list, to get that scale right, you'd have to put all the wonderful things that Indra's done as well on there. And then you have to put all the little things you've done. And then you see he's an Ishwara. He's a controller. So it's true. We may think like that. Oh, my father did this. Oh, then I'm better than my father. But actually, it may not be so. It may be just a calculation that we have done ourselves. So this is why it's so valuable to hear actively. Because you can ask all these questions and you can actually develop. In this way, you can develop your own understanding. So what does the mind do? The mind, this is very important, the mind can only think of what has already been. The mind has no access into the future. Just think about this. The intelligence projects all sorts of ideas. It'll be so nice if this happens and maybe that will happen, and so it dreams away. But the mind was always only drawing on the reference material of the past. And it projects, what it projects in the future is just a composite of the past. It has nothing to do with reality. We're so like out of touch, out of sync with reality most of the time. We're thinking this could be like this and that could be like that and that might be this, and we're drawing on this information. So then when we hear from something from the Bhagavatam, we can't use that method because we can't access this transcendental literature through the mind and its power to grasp and try and create and create a sort of a mosaic of what this is all about. And so, generally speaking, as I said, people come to the conclusion, oh, this must be a mythology because I can't make head or tail of it. I've never seen anyone has three heads. I've never seen this. I've never seen that. So therefore, so who are you? So first we have to understand, who are you, Mr. Ant? Who are you that you haven't seen this and you haven't seen that and you don't believe this and you don't believe that? You're just a foolish materialistic person. And these things are way, way, way beyond your range. If you want access to them, then you become a good student. Not that, oh, I can just take a bit here and there and make up my own views of reality. I can just take up this here and there and make up my own illusion. But I can't actually understand reality like that. It's very important to understand this as we develop in our Krishna consciousness, that my mind is troubling me about this, this, and this, and this, but why do I take it so seriously? It's just a composite of stuff. It's not reality. It's not what's going to happen even. And when we can do that, when we can actually see that, we have just this like a thin line between us and our mind is created, like a demarcation, a tatastha, an area in the middle of neutral ground. But that little tiny bit of neutral ground makes such a difference to our lives. Now, something comes into our mind, we act. We believe it's truth, it's reality. It has to be that way. But when that little space comes, maybe let me think about this for a minute. Let me check that what have I learned, and I go through some process of accessing what I've already learned spiritually, what I've already processed, and I'm using it in my life. Then it gives us that freedom not to act compulsively as materialistic persons, but to act as devotees. If we don't do this work of hearing and trying to grow, we won't grow. That's why this question, if I see Lord Vishnu, shouldn't I be pure already? No. You have to also be wanting that. You have to want in the right way, and you'll grow. Guaranteed you'll grow. And if you're not growing, well, you are growing. You're growing exactly how you want to grow. You change your direction of desire and you'll start growing in that way. You are growing. Krishna is giving you. He's giving you just what you want. And if you're getting a headache from it, that's because that's part of what you wanted. You didn't know it was, but it is. So take responsibility for it and offer it to him. Say, this is actually yours. Please may I use it in your service. Not, will you please come in here and fix it up? Can I use it in your service, please? This shift we have to make as devotees. Any more questions? Thank you. Very good question. Yes, sir. Because Premanjana doesn't mean your eyes are anointed with pure knowledge. What are your eyes anointed with? Premanjana. Prem. There is no prem in the material world. Prabhupada said, I saw a quote this morning, let's see if I wrote it down for you. Maybe I did not. But Prabhupada said, there is no prem in the material world. Prem is only for Krishna. The conditioned soul living within the purview of the material world cannot be expert in every type of materially enjoyable asset. But one can have considerable influence over a particular matter by worshipping a particular demigod, as mentioned above. This is in the second canto. But no demigod can solve the real problem of life, which is birth, death, disease, and old age. At the time of death, you have to leave it all, everything. Intelligent persons should try to avoid those aspirations for which they approach demigods and seek instead a permanent life by returning home back to Godhead. In the material world, there cannot be prema, love. This very word love is specially reserved for Krishna. So Duryodhana had no prema on his eyes. He didn't have that. He had something different. So mixed devotee, that means that the prema isn't what's yet on the eyes. The prema only comes when it's only Krishna. It's only Krishna that we want. And that we're not there yet. So we've had some struggles ahead. You can see here on the altar. Can you see him? Your eyes can see him. Can your mind see him? Can your heart see him? Not yet. So there's a process. There's a process by chanting the holy name. Do tears pour from your eyes whenever we hear kirtan? Do tears pour from your eyes whenever you're leading the kirtan? Not yet. Not yet. But there's a process. Yeah. There's a process. But no, we can't see Krishna until we have that premanjana. Not really. You can with your eyes see the deities, but premanjana is prem. Yes. 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 Well, it's a very good question. The question from one of the younger members of our class is, you said there's no prem in the material world, but we need prem to go back to Godhead. So it's a very good question. Now, if we were to see a tiny baby lying here, just born, 3 months old, 4 months old, lying here on a nice blanket, and you try to get them to walk, they're so tiny, they're only baby newborn, they can't walk. Right? You stand them up, can they walk? You can walk. How come you can walk and they can't walk? They haven't learned how to walk. But, you know, you can take a chair and walk it. What's the difference? The difference is that inherent within the baby is the ability to walk. It's inherent within the baby. Although the baby can't walk right now, they have the potential to be able to walk. So in due course of time, by getting older, now this analogy doesn't mean that as you make it years and years in Krishna consciousness, you automatically learn how to walk. But that part I will give a disclaimer to. But in due course of time, by practicing and practicing devotional service, it evokes this natural tendency to love Krishna. And there's a process. And it said that, for example, in the Bhagavatam, if you regularly hear the Bhagavatam, it will evoke this. And it says if you can't hear, if you have a hard time hearing the Bhagavatam, then serve a devotee. And by service to a devotee, then what happens is we start to be able to hear the Bhagavatam. We like it. We didn't like it before. It's amazing. I like it now. I didn't like it before. What happened? It has evoked some of that natural capacity to have prem. But if the baby grows up to be 3-4 years old and refuses to walk, they may not learn to walk, right? But they can walk. But they can't walk now. So prema, it's possible to evoke prema in the heart of all jivas. But there's a process to do that. How do you think? No problem. No problem.